the ones on Islamic and Chinese politics dealt mostly with 18th and 19th century Western intellectual history. There was a study by Manfred Henningsen on Toynbee's study of history, by Michael Naumann on Karl Kraus, by Eckhard Kolberg on LaSalle, by Hedda Herwig on Freud and Jung, by Thilo Schabert on the symbolisms of nature and revolution in the French 18th century, by Dagmar Herwig on Robert Musil. One should not forget from these years some work that had started with me in Louisiana by Professor Ellis Santos on Dostoevsky. The book first came out as a doctor's dissertation in Munich. During the 10 years, the first comers in the Institute grew older and became independent. One of them, Peter J. Opitz, became the highly active editor of a paperback, Geschichte des politischen Denkens, of which some 15 volumes have come out by now. You better count them. Mm-hmm. 15, I believe.
I count them.
Peter Opitz has also become the editor of a collective volume of essays on the Chinese Revolution from the middle of the 19th century to the communist movement. Others who entered later from other fields into the Institute have also produced interesting new studies. I should like to mention Klaus Fondu and his book on Manipulation und Magie. The older ones among the young people who started working with me are now themselves in professorial positions or near them, and the aggregate of the group and its work has become a distinct force in the German intellectual scene. So I cannot say that this particular force and group is loved by the ideologists, left or right. I am frequently asked about my experience regarding the difference between European and American students. There are marked differences, but not of such a nature that I should say the one type is preferable to the other. They have their peculiarities. With the Germans, I found a very high degree of background knowledge, which facilitated their transition to independent work in science. The people whom I admitted to my seminars, and especially the ones who then became assistants and conducted their own seminars, had a knowledge of at least one classical language, and of course were able to read German, French, and English fluently. Some of them had the special knowledge of their particular field. The Islamists, for instance, had, under the provision of the university, to have a good knowledge of Arabic and Turkish. The students dealing with Far Eastern affairs had to know Chinese and Japanese, in addition to the Western languages. That made for a group of highly educated, intellectually alert young people who certainly helped each other in the sharp contest of competitive debate of problems. One of the favorite games, of course, was always to catch me out on some technical mistake. But unfortunately, I could offer them the opportunity only rarely. The American students belonged to widely different types. In the situation of Louisiana, there was a considerable cultural background provided by the Catholic parochial schools. I had students in my class, in my courses, who knew Latin and who took courses in Thomistic philosophy with the Catholic chaplain at LSU. That, of course, helped. The general, or average students, I should say, did not have the background knowledge one would expect of European students, but they had instead something which the European, especially the German students, usually lack, a tradition of common sense culture. Especially in the South, the problem of ideological corruption among young people was negligible. The students were open-minded and had little touch with ideological sectarian movements. My experiences in the East were less favorable, because the ideological corruption of the East Coast has touched the student mind profoundly and deformed the existence of the student into totalitarian aggressiveness. A great number of students simply will not tolerate information that is not in agreement with their ideological prejudices. I had frequently difficulty with students of this type. Still, on the whole, even the so-called radical students, short of the hardcore militants, can be handled by swamping them with mountains of information. They still have enough common sense to be aware that somewhere their own ideas must bear a relation to the reality surrounding them. And when it is brought home to them that their picture of reality is more than dubious, they do not become easy converts, but at least they become shaken. I cannot say the same of radical students in Germany, who simply start shouting and rioting if any serious attempt is made to bring into discussion facts which are incompatible with their preconceptions. During the years in Louisiana, my wife and I acquired our American citizenship. One of the things in connection with it was quite funny. There was a leaflet issued by the Department of Justice in charge of immigration procedures, giving principal questions that could be asked and the answers one had to give. I noticed on that occasion that the Department of Justice, in spite of Roosevelt and the war, was still quite conservative. The American form of government was a republic. If you said it was a democracy, you were wrong. I believe these questionnaire leaflets have by now been changed. As far as my external position in Louisiana is concerned, I advanced from associate professor to full professor with tenure, and ultimately I became one of the first Boyd professors, together with T. Harry Williams, when the university introduced these named professorships in order to pay higher salaries to some scholars whose services they wanted to retain. Still, when in the second half of the 1950s the offers came to come to Munich, I did not simply refuse. The reasons were several. In the first place, I could organize my own institute and become effective in the training of young scholars who would continue the work which I had initiated. In the second place, at the time, the salary in Munich was higher than the salary in Louisiana. In the third place, old friends like Alois Dempf, the historian and philosopher, had been highly instrumental in getting me to Munich, and I certainly had no objections to enter this very congenial intellectual and spiritual environment. Besides, I had some ideas that perhaps a center of political science carried on in the spirit of American democracy would be a good thing to have in Germany. The beginnings under this last point were a bit difficult because German students were not accustomed to speak up freely as American students do. And even those who were then became assistants had to be pushed very energetically into a personally independent attitude which differed starkly from the very subordinate position in which assistants are kept in numerous cases by the old-style German professor. Not the least point of attractiveness in the institute I founded was the group of young people who so signally differed in the behavior which I inculcated in them from the type of behavior preferred in other institutes in Munich. On the whole, however, I believe that the idea of injecting an element of international consciousness into German political science and of democratic attitudes has not been much of a success beyond the immediate circle of the young people which I could train personally. As I later analyzed the situation in my lecture on the German university, the damage of National Socialism had been enormous. What one might call the universitarian upper stratum had simply been killed off. partly through emigration, partly through premature retirement, partly through actual killing. So that, for instance, the type of professors whom I still met in 1929 in Heidelberg had simply disappeared without leaving a younger generation trained by them. The universitarian middle and lower class had survived in force, and they determined the general climate of the German universities, and that was somewhat mediocre and limited. The after effects of National Socialism make themselves felt in the contemporary destruction of the German university through an invasion of the rebel from below, to which university personnel cannot offer any effective resistance, because the authority of the great scholars in the universities has disappeared with the scholars. The general prospects, therefore, I should consider very dubious. When I say the prospects are dubious, I mean that, in fact, the active operation of the universities, especially in the fields of the social sciences and the humanities, has been widely destroyed through the famous democratization and participatory democracy, which means, in fact, that nobody is left in peace to do his work. In a case like Berlin, for instance, leftist students simply do not permit anybody to open his mouth who would be in conflict with Marxism. And I hear that similar situations exist in other universities, as for instance in Marburg. Munich was, fortunately, preserved from the worst effects, partly because, through my institute, there was a strong core of non-ideological science. I would like to stress this point, because it is sometimes underrated, what effect a professor can have, not by his personal throwing around of his weight, but by having educated in his courses and seminars 2 or 3 years of students who then become an effective propaganda force against ideologists among the other students. That, of course, will wear off if an energetic attitude is not maintained, or if it is made ineffective by increasing the staff from mediocre people who cannot properly resist radical students in debate.